There's no free lunch when it comes to investing. But what about a podcast that delivers educational content on investing, financial planning, items of interest, and even the odd wacky topic? Welcome to the Free Lunch Podcast, hosted by Canvas Wealth. Free Lunch will bring listeners the team's vast knowledge and experience in dealing with uncertainty. Learn more and subscribe today at canvaswealth.ca.
Welcome back to the Free Lunch Podcast with Greg and Colin. Greg, we've had the fortune of having a number of great guests this year. It's actually a little surprising sometimes when somebody says yes, but we're always very humble about who has been on the show, and today's another example of that. Today we are interviewing somebody that most Canadian investors would know, right?
Yep,
absolutely. So it's Rob Carrick. Rob is one of Canada's most trusted personal finance journalists. Rob spent 27 years as the personal finance columnist at the Globe and Mail, where he became known for making complex money topics clear and practical for everyday Canadians. And before joining the Globe in 1996, he reported on Bay Street and federal finance issues for the Canadian press. In 2025, Rob stepped back from his full-time role and entered semi-retirement, similar to you, Greg, actually.
I think Rob's a little busier than I am these days.
Well, he continues to write occasional Globe columns, publish a Substack newsletter, speak on financial literacy, and really the pinnacle of any career, a spot on the Free Lunch Podcast.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Rob, maybe tell the listeners where you're joining us from today.
I am joining you from my office in the condo where I live with my wife in Ottawa.
Ah, the nation is out.
Snowing heavily.
Oh, really? Okay. Sorry to hear that.
Well, you can't escape it. Yeah. So maybe tell us a little bit about your story. How did you get started in this field back in 1996 or before?
You know, I got interested in personal finance because of where I was in my life. I was in my younger 30s. I had family, I had a house, and all these financial questions. And I was interested in the answers. And I noticed that personal finance was starting to become something that that journalists were writing about. I think there was a guy named Bruce Cohen was writing about personal finance in the Financial Post. And I said to my bosses at the Globe and Mail, where I was an investment reporter, that we should really be doing more about this personal finance stuff. And I volunteered to do something on that file. And they said, how about you become the Globe and Mail's personal finance columnist? And I said, yes, please. And I just ran with it. And that was about 27 years ago.
Wow. Well, that's great. And as we mentioned before we started recording, we've been reading your articles. You know, as professionals, supposedly professionals, it's always good to read what people are saying and what individuals are reading, because, you know, that's how you know where to focus with them, you know, when you know what they're seeing. So when you look back and you see where Canadian investors are today compared to where they were maybe, you know, 27 years ago, where do you think Canadians are most financially vulnerable right now? Like, what are the risks that we're facing these days?
You know what? The biggest risk is a household risk. And I was just like 20 minutes ago reading a chart that showed levels of household debt in Canada versus the US versus the Eurozone. And the debt levels on a household basis in Canada are so much higher. And I thought, I kind of knew that, but see that chart really, really, you know, slap me in the face. Much higher than in the U.S. The U.S. has deleveraged significantly in the past 15 or so years. Canada has not. And I'm thinking that is really a big time vulnerability. You know, interest rates, you know, we just saw the Bank of Canada hold rates steady. I don't think any interest rate cuts are coming. Like, the bond market, see yields are starting to rise a bit, and we're vulnerable. It handcuffs people. They're putting money into debt repayment, not into investments. They're not able to put money away for retirement. So I think that might be our big vulnerability. I think there's too much money allocated towards consumption and repayment of debt and not enough towards building assets. And when we do build assets, it's past being tilted, I think, excessively to real estate, not enough to liquid investable assets going into RSPs and TFSAs and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, we have a we're kind of mixed up here about what we're doing with our money. And I think, you know, deleveraging, lowering debt levels would be a very, very helpful development, especially when you look at all the uncertainty that's sort of baked into the 2026 outlook.
Well, on that note, do you think it has something to do with, I want to say, a younger generation being more comfortable having debt than a past generation?
I think boomers wrote the book on being comfortable with debt. Mm. I mean, I look at the rise of the HELOC when I was started writing, you know, decades ago, there was the home equity line of credit, but it was kind of a boutique kind of thing. And only sort of more financially savvy people had one. And most of them sort of kept it behind glass and only used it for specific situations. And then gradually people started to use it as, you know, the quote ATM unquote, and basically to finance their lifestyles, to let them buy things they couldn't afford and finance them on an indefinite basis. And I think that's a boomer thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the template for what's happening now. I think young people are perhaps overspending, but when I look at the problem with debt, I don't see it. I don't see them being at the tip of the spear, so to speak. I think it's boomers. And I think it's maybe Gen Xers and some millennials who bought houses that they really couldn't afford to carry. They could afford to buy them, but carrying them is the problem. They're basically house poor.
Yeah, so thanks a lot, Greg. It's your generation that screwed it up for everybody else.
I guess so.
Well, as a Gen Xer, I can say that. But what else you got, Greg?
Well, just, you know, when we talk about, you know, consumers or individual investors, so what... And maybe you've touched on a little bit, you know, with debt is I was going to ask you, like, what is the one financial habit that the average Canadian investor gets wrong? Is it the use of debt? What else are we doing wrong here?
Well, you know what? I think we're just too comfortable with taking on debt. And, you know, I think if we could dial back attitudes towards debt to what they were about 20 odd years ago, when, you know, debt was sort of viewed with a bit with distaste and sort of, it's almost like a defeat if you took on debt. You accepted it because you had to do it, but you did it reluctantly. And now it's much more comfortable. But I don't think we can roll that one back.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the drive to consumerism is too strong. You know, like young people today and even older generations are on social media, they're on their phones, they're constantly being bombarded with messages to buy about what the great lifestyle looks like, about what their friends are doing, where they're going. And I think that there are so many prompts to buy that didn't used to exist that it is very hard to resist them. And I think, you know, many, many people are overspending in ways they might not have done, you know, 20, 30 or 40 or whatever years ago, because they're just immersed in this culture of buying, buying, buying. You know, I'm hearing, I had a coffee with a financial planner who is a Gen Xer / millennial. He's got a lot of clients with sort of young kids. And she's talking about how these young kids are buying things online using their parents' credit cards. And it's just like this idea that I don't really know what debt is. I just buy stuff and it seems to work out okay. And I think that's what we've sort of built for the younger people today. And I think older people are in that world too, you know, where there's so little friction to buying and to seeing where the debt takes you that you just go down this road and you don't even realize what's happened to you.
I got to share a quick story about that. So when I was in high school, which was quite a while ago now, one of my classmates went to Cancun for spring break. And it was so rare that her nickname for the rest of the school year became Cancun. And, you know, as my kids were going through high school, it wasn't like if somebody was going somewhere for spring break, it was where everybody was going. It became unbelievable, you know, so kind of, you know, trying to live up to that lifestyle that everybody sees online, I guess.
It's, you know what, it doesn't get enough discussion, really. Like, we keep looking at the symptoms of that or overspending and all that. But the idea of teaching young people and even teaching older people, you know, the limits of what they should be spending, there's not enough attention on that. And I think part of the reason is that no one wants to be this naysayer saying, cut back, cut back, cut back. And because that is a message that doesn't really resonate. But nevertheless, maybe we just need to teach people that, you know, don't be a sucker. Basically, you're being told to buy stuff. It's not so you have a better life. It's so companies can make more money.
Yeah.
That's what's happening here. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can empower people like that way, just to be a little bit more critical about their purchases, a little bit more critical about the messages and the influencers and all the material they're seeing to buy. I mean, just maybe we just need slightly more savvy consumers. I don't know. It's just a thought, but I think we need to think about ways to reallocate household spending so it doesn't all go to consumption.
You know, you brought up a point when you're talking about home ownership, and obviously it's something that's getting more and more difficult for younger people. You know, it's always been the dream, you know, the American dream, and I'm assuming the Canadian dream as well, is that, you know, you'll own your own home and that feeling of security or whatever that home ownership brings you. But is home ownership overrated? You know, because certainly, as you say, you can lock yourself up in, you know, be house poor, you know, by taking on a big mortgage that you can't maybe afford, or you have to really stretch for it? And are people passing on other opportunities by doing that? Because it just, it takes so much of your monthly cash flow.
Yes, is the answer to your question.
Okay, let's move on.
Overrated. But you know what? People really want to own homes. And I think most people will be happiest in life if they do own a home. But I do think, you know, we need to get the message out that you can live a life as a renter. And if you are a shrewd and consistent and aggressive investor, you can build up assets in an investment, your TFSA and your RSP and your non-registered account that could be a counterweight to the home equity that the home buyer has. And, you know, I mean, you could, when you reach retirement, what would you rather have? A bunch of home equity that you could only access through a HELOC or a reverse mortgage, or unless you sell and downsize to something much smaller, or to have a nice liquid investment portfolio that you could do whatever you want with, including withdrawing money with a few clicks of your mouse. So I think we need to talk that up a little bit too. But, you know, I think the emotional and financial side together makes most people happiest if they own a home. And that is why people, you know, really continue, even though we've seen homes become so unaffordable, people still aspire to own them.
Well, that's one of the reasons why Calgary's had such a boom in population this last decade, is because the average home price has been a little lower than in the rest of Canada. And we have jobs, right?
That's right.
But they're still, yeah, like I think of even my own kids. I mean, my son moved out into a condo at 22. You know, that's not something that that I did, right? I mean, we rented.
Oh, yeah.
But that's, I don't know. It's weird.
Well, you know, and your point about, you know, being a renter slash investor as opposed to homeowner, it's one that it's, as you say, I think it's a tough sale. But I think back to my own situation and, of course, just being honest about my age. I mean, I'm 71. I was born in 1954. And I grew up in Regina. My parents bought their first home when I was born for $11,000. So it's like, okay, well, that's, you know, it sounds like, you know, the horse and buggy era. But when I started in this business in 96, I did the experiment. Okay, what's that home worth in Regina in 1996? And it was worth, I don't know, $150,000. Seems like a reasonable return. And the old Templeton Growth Fund mountain chart was worth about $1.5 million. So that $11,000 would have been a lot better spent, even, you know, a fraction of it going into Templeton Growth Fund every year. So the numbers absolutely support investing, but I take your point. The emotional comfort of owning your own home, knowing that theoretically nobody can kick you out of it other than the bank possibly, is all part.
When people are raising families and they want their kids to grow up in a home with a backyard, even though plenty of people around the world raise their kids in apartments, it's a thing that happens. Yeah. But anyway, I think our view of real estate was also like influenced a lot by what happened, you know, in the past 12, 15 years when housing prices in Canada soared, and then the pandemic came and there was like this little pullback period, and then interest rates were slashed to zero, and then there was this epic surge higher in home prices. I remember I was writing for the Globe, and anything I put on their website about real estate just got monster numbers of clicks.
Yeah,
people were obsessed. Basically, I spent 6 months writing about nothing but home prices and, you know, how absurd things were getting. You know, like just I counted up the number of towns and cities in the country that had average $1 million prices, and it was getting up close to double digits. And, you know, I grew up in Toronto, north end of Toronto. There was a town about an hour northwest called Barrie, Ontario, which was sort of like the gateway to cottage country. Nice little town, but, you know, nothing that really, you know, would make you think that it was a $1 million city, but it actually either became one or became very close to one. And I was thinking, wow, that is just out of this world. But that influenced a lot of people. They've got to get into the housing market. And they did. And now they're renewing those mortgages at way higher rates. And, you know, their house may not have increased in value, may actually have gone down. And they're seeing that housing is not a surefire investment asset. And I'm hoping that sort of convinces more people that your real estate shouldn't be all your money, that you need to diversify, own your home, but do some investing on the side. Don't invest in a second property. That was a big thing. Invest in public markets for stocks, bonds, et cetera, and have a counterweight to real estate.
Well, yeah, good points. Let's move on from real estate because we're going to run out of time. But let's talk about behavioral biases, because Greg and I have a big focus in our practice on on understanding behavioral biases, stick handling with clients through them. And one of the things we often tell them to do is to just ignore the headlines, because there's a lot of headlines out there that can raise fear levels. What would you say, how do you personally filter out the noise when you're surrounded by headlines all day?
You know, it's tough. I mean, I feel it's my job to take in the headlines and be able to synthesize what they're saying to people in something useful and hopefully reassuring. I don't know if it's possible to tune out the headlines. And I don't just necessarily mean the financial ones, but there's so much news and we take it in so many different ways, including our phones, which are with us all the time now. I wonder if it's even reasonable to ask people not to kind of ignore the headlines. And I think that we, you know, it's worth saying and it's worth encouraging to do that. And it's worth, you know, exploring that. But I think what we also have to do is say, here are the enduring truths of investing that supersede the headlines about what the Bank of Canada is doing and what you know, the US is doing and what's happening in the trade war, you know. And that is that if you hold stocks for decades, you make lots of money.
Yeah.
And that you have to be able to take a punch once in a while if you're going to invest in stocks, but you will do great if you hold on through all of that. You know, I don't know what you guys found in February, March, when the stock market was crashing because the trade war was on, but I found like stunning levels of panic among some of the people globally who were getting in touch with me. Like they were thinking, I want to sell. And I would say, but why sell? I mean, this will be dealt with and stocks will come back from whatever adversity is ahead. And they were saying, but I'm retired and I don't think I'm going to live long enough for that to happen. Yeah. Well, it turned out it only took like 3 months for it to happen. Yeah. So when he did live long enough. But I think the headlines are really extreme now. And I think people like you and people like me just have to be constantly talking about the bigger picture that goes beyond this and that connects all the crises and all the bull markets and shows that, wow, stocks still produce lots of great gains. Like that, you know, the Templeton Growth Fund, does it even exist anymore? Like that is
that's right.
That it's like ancient history. But it used to be the reference mutual fund in Canada, but now it is just, you know, I don't know. I mean, the whole Templeton thing seems to have it's been superseded by ETFs,
sure,
and many other things. But the message is that long term investing in stocks is very rewarding, and that really, if you're doing anything when it happens, you should be buying more, not panicking and not finding ways to sell. But you know, I think behavioral biases you're talking about, the bias is to do something in a moment of crisis, take action, be bold, protect. And that means selling in the face of adversity, which rarely works out.
Well, I've always, I used to compare it to that whole concept of the need to do something to, you know, sports teams when they have a bad season or a few bad games and they fire the coach. It is a natural instinct to want to do something because to feel like you have some control over the outcome, which of course we know we don't in this case.
Yeah.
Right. You know what the thing to do, and I know I'm sure you do this and I try to do this too, is that you build portfolios so that they can withstand this. That's the action you took. You took it in the past and you can make some micro adjustments, but it's like the foundational building and blueprints of your portfolio are what protect you.
Like, sure,
you've diversified you. You've got this, you've got that, you've got bonds, cash, GICs, whatever. You've got a hedge against, you know, the stock markets. And it's almost like you have to tell them this was planned for.
Mm-hmm.
It's expected. And it will be, you know, it will go okay. You will be fine. And, but you know, everybody's so jangly about a million different things right now, including investments. So that must make your job extra hard these days, because the emotional pitch of your clients has got to be—it's got to be pretty, pretty stressed in many cases. And I wonder if it was like that 10, 20 years ago.
Well, that's a good point, because we have a client, not a newer client, but somebody who recently came into wealth through an inheritance, and you know, we invested their money just the way we said we would, based on market cycles, the cyclicality of markets. And I got an email from him yesterday, a kind of a panic email, because he was down, I don't know, $5,000, and he wanted to know what we were going to do about it. And I said, hey, it's been 6 days, you know, like 6 days, like your portfolio is down 0.6%. I mean, that's a hard one to to deal with.
That's a hard one to deal with. And boy, what's going to happen if the market drops like 7% in a day or something like that?
Yeah.
But I mean, I think, you know what? Don't you find that this bull market is starting to, it's, I almost think enough already. Like it's the amount of investing success people have had is starting to warp them. And so someone who can't take a $5,000 loss, which is inconsequential in the light of their portfolio, it just reminds me that we've, like, there's a whole group of investors who've had 5 years of pretty much nonstop success,
yeah,
and that they don't have it anymore, they're going to be in pain.
It's interesting because every bull market seems to become the most hated bull market in history because they do tend to go on, you know, and that's one of those things that, you know, you even you know, being in the business, we have to learn over and over again is that, you know, you can look at valuations and they may seem high, but they're not good, you know, they're not good for timing. But you do start to believe that, okay, like when people start to think that they can't lose, that's when things get dangerous. Yeah, we went through that, I guess. Well, we've been through it numerous times.
The three of us have been through all of those cycles that we talked about earlier at the same time.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
A question for you about some of the innovations in investment. I mean, there's been a lot of innovations, robo-advice. Well, I mean, from when I started, it was the early days of discount brokerages, now called do-it-yourself investing. Robo advisors, we've got low cost ETFs, we've got factor investing, a la dimensional funds and things. So which of those would you think has genuinely improved outcomes for Canadians?
I think they all have. I think they all have produced more good than negative.
Yep.
In fact, I don't really know. I'd have to think about it hard, but I think most of the invested, like ETFs, low cost investing, digital investing via what started as discount brokers have now become trading apps with no commissions. And I know there's some, you know, there's some downside to it. It's like there's people making stupid trades and building habits of speculation that are going to hurt them. But every generation of investors had a toy that hurt them. Yeah. You know, it was in the tech wreck. It was like the very beginning of discount brokers and everybody was buying Nortel with that and then blew their brains out. I know older boomers who had their little fling with penny mining stocks and blew their brains out. So it, you know what, we will get past this and there will be net good continuing to come out of robo-advisors and ETFs and trading apps. I mean, I think young generation views on investing has been warped a bit by this, you know, the great investing results of the past 5 years, but they are pretty savvy about the need to invest and the idea of taking some of my money and investing it. I think we need to fine tune how they do it and what their expectations are, but the habit's been built. And I think that's really good. I mean, it might, you know, previous generations might've needed to live 10 more years until they figured out what investing was and how to get serious about it. So I'm comfortable with these innovations and that there's a greater good served by them, but I wouldn't want to pretend that they're all good and there's no negatives.
But what an amazing time for a younger person to be investing because they've got access to so much more information than the three of us had when we started our careers, right? I mean, you can go on to ChatGPT and ask it absolutely anything and get a pretty good response, right? So on that note, and on what you just said, Greg, we view products as a problem sometimes. A problematic product, that's a mouthful, Greg, that's prevalent, that's three piece, in the marketplace today is structured notes. Structured notes have just exploded. And honestly, and I don't know how you feel about this, Rob, we're just not on side with them. And we feel that they're overhyped. Are there products like that that you could also expand on?
I'm going to go back about 15, close to 20 years, and these structured notes had a previous life as the principal protected note.
Yes,
and they were red hot, and they were so complex and loaded with fees and conditions and terms that investors never really paid attention to because they love the idea of principal protection. And I think the structured note boom is sort of like another gasp of that product. This idea that these genius financial engineers will produce a great product for me that will let me participate in the stock market, but will put, you know, limits on what I could lose or somehow give me a more predictable gain. And You know what? I think it's just the financial industry trying to offer products for people who want to invest in stocks but can't really face up to the risks of stocks, mm-hmm. or can't intellectualize diversification and so can't be comfortable. And I don't like them either. I think they are just trickery. I think they're just financial engineering designed to give people an experience that doesn't really exist, you know, risk-free investing in stocks or low-risk investing in stocks. I think people who buy structured notes just buy a GIC. You know, it's much more transparent. It's clear. It's predictable. Yeah. And then buy some stocks there. I like have some GICs and some stocks. There's so many ways to produce a better outcome and a similar outcome to structured notes. But you know what? People want that pretend I'm investing in stocks, but I've really, really pared down the risk experience.
Well, sorry, Greg, I just got a follow up to that. Is, you know, years ago, the principal protected notes, of course, were being pitched hard to us. And I remember a colleague said to me, why would anybody do this? Why don't they just buy a strip bond and then put the difference into the equity market and save all the fees, right?
Yep. Yep. Because marketing rules. You know what? I've got this product for you, Mr. and Mrs. Investor, that lets you invest in bank stocks and you could make this much. Usually it's like a total amount for the term, not an annualized amount. And you know what? The downside risk is zero or this much. And people really like that sales pitch.
It's interesting. When we became fiduciaries, you know, because as you know, when I started and when Colin started in the business, we were as investment advisors, we were
salespeople,
which, by the way, I've been a salesperson most of my working career. Nothing wrong with that, but you have to look at what are you selling and what's your objective. But so when we look back at those times of being non-fiduciaries and now being in the role of fiduciaries and having the what everyone assumed was your responsibility to act in the investor's best interest. When we come to things like structured notes, I mean, most of the people that we used to work with couldn't explain to themselves, couldn't understand how these things were structured with derivatives and options and things. And how in the world is somebody going to explain that to an individual investor, how these things are structured to provide the very different outcomes based on how the market performs? So it just seemed like not what a fiduciary might offer to their clients.
Well, especially at 2.5-3% commissions, really high.
So just a little bit on that note, just for fun, when you look back over the last, 27 years, what investing fad would you think looks the most ridiculous in retrospect?
High fee mutual funds. You know, I think the mutual fund industry sort of had a little thing going where it was kind of a monopoly investment for the masses, and they took advantage of that.
Yep.
And I think that basically they kind of poisoned the well for themselves by not becoming more fee conscious earlier on. And they are basically, I consider them like a sunset asset, really. I mean, you can't say that on assets, still tons of assets. You know, there's some RBC balance funds with like 50 odd billion dollars in them. So they've still got their market share, but their day is done. And I think growth will be very hard to accomplish in the years ahead. And I think they charge too much. They paid in advisors too much. You know, remember when front end commissions could be 4 or 5%, and then deferred sales commissions could be significant. And then they got that rid of that, but the MERs were high, and MERs are much more competitive now. And there's many good products in the mutual fund industry. But I used to say to investing people, you know, my latter years at the Globe, like, how many questions do you think I got on mutual funds from readers over the years? And if I got one or two a year, that was pretty standard.
Yeah.
ETFs, way more questions. I got questions about everything but mutual funds. And I thought, that's really interesting, because engaged investors aren't asking about this. Before, it was like mega levels of questions about mutual funds, but it's just dwindled down. And I was thinking, you know, they say passive investing is tracking the markets through index investing, but I think passive investing is holding mutual funds. It's the investment held by the people who don't ask questions.
Well, the fees definitely have come down a lot. One of the products that we use in our models years ago had an MER of just over 1%. Mm-hmm. And in January, that MER is being cut to 0.35% just in the last 5 years.
That's an exceptional fee cut. And I mean, even I'm okay with around 1%. If combined with the advice fee I'm paying my advisor, that comes up to probably 2%. If it gives me a return that is either you know, at close to what the indexes are making, or maybe it's less volatility, and so I'm getting some value from there. I'm open to that.
Yeah.
But when the MER was like 2.85,
yeah,
yes,
or even 3 for some specialty products, or in the high twos or mid to high twos for balanced products where bonds were like 40% of the portfolio, then I'm thinking that's just too much. And I think investors have become a lot smarter about paying fees, and like they want value. And if they don't see it, they're gone.
Sure. I remember shortly before I retired, we're looking at a lot of the Morningstar information where they would basically say the single biggest predictor of mutual fund success relative to market performance was the MER.
Yeah.
The lower the MER, the more likelihood of meeting or exceeding, you know, returns. Yeah.
Right. And the MER was the only thing that you could count on going forward. Because remember the star managers and mutual fund land?
Oh, yes.
They all basically like lost their mojo and became obscure.
Yeah.
And it turned out that the one thing you could count on with a fund, you can't count on the manager, you can't count on the math asset mix, you can't count on passive returns. But going forward, the MER was one thing you could lock onto. That's your friend going forward.
Yeah. Well, and I think a lot of people, and we're getting a little long here, but just to carry on that, you know, everybody gets focused on MER, but we often ask clients, well, what about the TER? What about the trade expense ratio that nobody reports? You know, if you've got a super active fund, I mean, you might be adding, I don't know, 20, 25 basis points on top of the MER.
Totally. You're 100% right. I mean, there are some funds that do a lot of trading, and that creates drag on returns. And it's TERs are there for the taking. If you look at the mutual funds reports of performance, or if you look at fund facts documents or ETF facts documents, but it's hard enough to get people to pay attention to MERs. TERs is a whole other thing, but you're totally right. That is extra cost.
Yeah. Greg, what last question can we give Rob? Because we are running late and I don't like to keep him longer. He's got things to write about, Greg.
Well, that's right. And, you know, and obviously we could talk for hours. So maybe Rob will even agree to come back on the program another time.
Yes.
I'm glad.
But so just in closing, so what gives you optimism about Canadians' financial future?
I think that people are getting a lot smarter about money. They're confused. There's a lot of voices out there. They don't know who to pay attention to, but you don't have to tell them to pay attention. They're doing that. And I right. think they've realized that everybody needs to raise their game a little bit. We need to be smarter about all our financial choices. We can't make perfect choices all around, but I think people are really hungry for information. You know, I wrote personal finance on a daily basis for 27 years. And I think every year more people paid more attention as I went along. And I think I've noticed more younger people are into it. Seniors are into it. Everybody is. And I think that gives me hope. People are really engaged with it. Yeah. And I think that means that good outcomes are possible if they get the right guidance.
Yeah.
Well, that's an excellent note to end this session on. So,
yeah.
Listen, thank you, Rob. That was a great discussion, and we have so much to talk about.
Yeah, literally could talk for like another hour, but nobody wants to listen to you and me, Greg, anyways, for another hour. Yeah. But yeah, thanks for coming on, Rob. Really appreciate that. And as I said in when I reached out to you, longtime reader, first-time caller, really appreciate you coming on the show.
I was glad to do it. Great chat, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Free Lunch Podcast hosted by Canvas Wealth. To subscribe to this podcast to get more realistic insights on investing or to connect with one of our talented partners, please head on over to canvaswealth.ca. We'll see you next time on the Free Lunch Podcast.
Financial planning services are offered through Canvas Wealth. Portfolio management services are provided by Q Wealth Partners, a registered portfolio manager, investment fund manager, an exempt market dealer. Canvas is an owner and partner in the Q Wealth Partnership. The information discussed in this show, including any opinion, is based on various sources believed to be reliable, but subject to change. The opinions expressed in this show are opinions of the individuals, and they have not been approved by, and are not necessarily those of, Q Wealth as a firm. This is not legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice, and should not be relied as such.